You would have been under a rock not to have noticed that it's been a wild time for weather, both here in New Zealand and overseas during the past month. And to tell us all about it is former Met Service severe weather meteorologist Eric Brenstrom, who's joining us for the first time this year from our Wellington studio. Good evening, Eric.
Kia ora, Karen.
Did you have a nice summer? Well, it's not over yet, is it?
Oh, we have, yeah. Wellington's been pretty good. We've been having what's called a La Nina event, and that tends to make it rain at the top of the North Island and in the east down towards Gisborne. But Wellington has less rain than normal, warmer than normal, and less wind than normal.
Very nice. But when does summer officially end? You'd sort of think we're just going into it now, wouldn't you?
You often have the best weather at the end of January going into February, and that's partly because the weather's controlled by the ocean temperatures, and they take a while to warm up going into summer, and then they take a while to cool down going into autumn. The best is probably still to come.
Fantastic. And on the news bulletin's showing us that it was an extremely cold Christmas for many in North America. What happened there?
There was a huge outbreak of cold air from the Arctic moving down over Canada and then over the United States. So they had blizzard conditions with snow blowing and gale force winds, visibility dropping down to tens of metres. And that made driving conditions very hazardous. And one of the problems they had was that people pulled over the side of the road and tried to wait it out. But if you can't keep your engine going, eventually you get cold in the car. And that was how a number of the people died, was from exposure. I think there was over 60 people died. But the heaviest snow was downwind from Lake Erie around the town of or city of Buffalo. And that's because as the very cold air goes over the lake, which is warmer than the air by quite a lot, air temperature could be minus 20, you get an awful lot of water evaporate into the air, and also heat is transferred into the air. So that extra water evaporating then becomes snow. And the end result was, I think, 2 to 3 metres of snow in parts of Buffalo. And that was probably the heaviest snow in the event. But there's another thing goes on with the lake as well. And that's like almost a great big bathtub. The water in the lake oscillates from one end to the other. It rocks. They call it seiching, with a period of maybe 3 hours. And that means the water can come up onto the land, but you also have the waves on the water. So you get a lot of spray breaking over, sometimes over some of the houses quite close to the water. But as that spray becomes tiny droplets in the air, it becomes colder than freezing, but still liquid. And then when it hits the side of a house, then it turns to ice. So you end up with these great sheets of frozen water down the front of some of these houses, which is quite spectacular to look at. And that event was lasted quite a few days, and also behind the cold air, a low dip developed, what they call a bomb cyclone. It deepened by more than 24 hectopascals in 24 hours. And so that intensified the winds, and they also got storm surge on the east coast where the sea was coming up over the land. So there was a lot of trouble in a lot of places, aircraft not flying, trains stopped, cars dropped. So, quite dramatic.
Why does Lake Erie rock, the water on it rock? Is it just a natural phenomenon?
Yes, and it happens in all the Great Lakes. In fact, it happens all over the place. I think I saw it in Wellington Harbour about 3 or 4 months ago when I was watching it on a fairly calm day, and I suddenly realised there was a rock that kept coming out of the water and then going back under, and it wasn't because of waves, and it had a period of about 5 or 6 minutes. So any open body of water that's got wind blowing across it, you can end up with this phenomena, and it affects, things around the shore. I think at the western end of Lake Erie, they had the lowest lake level on record during this last event.
Geez, so terrible being in one of those houses if you've got that freezing spray over the front of it.
Well, yes. I'm not sure if the houses get damaged. It may be that they're built to take the extra weight, and so they just sort of shrug it off after a while. It would be futile going outside and trying to break it off because it would reform so fast. I'd love to chat to someone who lived in one of those houses, find out what it's like.
Might be somebody listening. From one extreme to the other, Eric, it's been a terrible winter so far for European ski fields. What's been happening in that part of the world?
Well, just as you had a huge amount of air spill out from the Arctic over the United States, what you then tend to have is if you go downstream, say 60 degrees of longitude, you'll get the wind in the opposite direction. So there was a strong wind blowing out of Africa over Western Europe, which led to a tremendous amount of heat records being broken, the hottest ever days in January, and I think in Spain and Bilbao in the north, they got to 25.1 degrees, which was 10 degrees above average. Warsaw got to 18.9, which was 4 degrees higher than the previous record. Normally when records get broken, it's by 0.1 or 0.2 of a degree, so to break it by 4 was stunning. And this also, the warmth effect of the Ukraine. And one of the things there is that you can do warfare in winter when the ground's like concrete, or in summer when the ground's like concrete. But in spring and autumn, it's very hard because the ground turns to mud. So I think the warmth going through there in the Ukraine may have held off some of the battles. Some of the people might be getting ready to make a big move as soon as the ground gets really hard again. So I keep watching the news with interest. But yeah, getting back to playtime with the snow, the ski fields, some of the sort of winter races had to be cancelled. You saw photos of green fields with little ribbons of white snow where they'd got the snowmaking machines out coming down to give at least a tiny strip people could snow on. But the other thing too is that then you get, with less snow and ice holding the rocks together in the mountains, you get more rock falls, particularly if you went back to July when there was one in Italy where it came down many thousands of metres, and unfortunately there were a group of hikers down in a valley, and I think 11 of them got buried under the avalanche and were killed.
Oh, gee, and it must have absolutely created havoc with the ski season in terms of, just written it off.
Well, that's right, which has enormous economic consequences for many of the higher towns and villages in the Alps from Italy and Austria all the way through to Spain and France. So it's not trivial. And the other thing, of course, is that with less of that snow and ice, that means once they go into the next summer, there's less snow melt coming down the rivers. So they're more vulnerable to extreme water shortages if they go into a dry summer.
And back here in New Zealand, it was more bad news for our glaciers. They've been melting for a while now, but it's getting worse.
Yes, that's right. I came across a wonderful book called Vanishing Ice that came out like a couple of months ago by Lindley Hargraves. And it's got fantastic photographs of the mountains and of the glaciers now and as they were more than 100 years ago. And you can see this staggering decrease in almost all of them. I mean, when I was young, there was no lake in front of, the big glaciers coming down past Mount Cook. And now there's huge lakes of meltwater there. One of the figures in the book, they said, I think from 2015 to 2019, there was an almost sevenfold increase in the rate of melt of our glaciers compared to the period 2001 to 2005. So it's accelerating, which is happening worldwide, I think. And with the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets, there's also been something like a fourfold increase in the melt rate compared to the 1990s. So it's not just that we're getting warmer, but things are accelerating.
What's the projection then in terms of that acceleration?
Well, if we can't hold back on burning coal and oil and gas, producing greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide, then we could be looking at a significant melt of West Antarctic ice sheet and the Greenland ice sheet by the end of this century, with perhaps more than a metre of sea level rise. And I read somewhere a while ago, I meant to go and check it, that a metre of sea level rise actually takes out about half the world's food producing areas, which are concentrated close to sea level around the where the big rivers meet the ocean, like the Ganges, the Brahmaputra, the Yangtze, the Mississippi, the Rhine. A lot of farming goes on just in the flatlands around where they meet the ocean. So it's a terrific threat to food production, aside from the fact that the heat will sometimes mean some of the plants that we grow now won't grow anymore.
Oh, it's all bad news, really. I was reading also that regard to the glaciers, that in the European Alps that we've been talking about, that the glaciers there are expected to vanish almost and completely by 2100.
Yes, that's if we don't make significant reductions in the way we're burning coal and oil and gas. And similarly for the New Zealand glaciers, I mean, most of the glaciers and mountain ranges around the world will be going, including the Himalaya, where in summertime the ice melt is a hugely important factor for agriculture, and also in the Andes. Again, in summer, the ice melt is what feeds agriculture. I've read somewhere that this is a far worse problem than the war in Ukraine, even though, you know, we're following the war in Ukraine every night on the news, and it's terrible. But climate change is in the background, and for some people, it might seem it's so little by little that they don't quite see it coming, but we're heading towards various, you know, tripping points, as they call them. One of the ones I remember reading about was the idea that London, for example, will cease to be a functioning port once they get to the stage where they have to drop the barrier to stop the sea coming up and invading the underground railway system.
Really, and up the Thames?
Yes, they've got a huge barrier they put in about 40 years ago. It used to be when it first went in, the Thames barrier was used maybe once every 3 or 4 years. I think it's now up to being used about 3 or 4 times a year. But they're looking to a possible future when that will be in operation for maybe a third of the year, and then you can't get ships up to the port, so you have to find another port to do all your business and unload all your gear. So there are all sorts of consequences when you look in all sorts of directions. So it's imperative that we make a move on, you know, renewable energy and those sorts of things.
And on the same subject, these weather events, California is more well known for its droughts than floods, but been unusually wet this month. How much rain have they been getting?
Oh, a lot. I think places have had over half a metre. And one of the things that's gone on there is that they've had a repeat weather system 3 or 4 times in a row. So this is the other thing that can happen sometimes, that the weather will send another front following the front before that, so that you end up getting cumulatively an awful lot of rain. They were in a very, very bad drought. So on the one hand, it's been great for pushing the water levels in the reservoirs up. I think most of the reservoirs have gone up above average now, and also they've got a good snowpack. So that, to some degree, is beneficial. But again, this is the sort of thing that could become worse in the future, because as the world gets warmer, warm air can hold more water gas, which then gets used to produce rain if you've got a front or a low or a hurricane nearby. But then the sobering thing in California is they know they've had huge floods in the past, now and again. 1861, they had one that completely flooded the inland valley, making a lake about 30 kilometres wide and 450 kilometres long. And they've also done sediment studies on the ocean and some of the lakes to show that really big floods have happened in California roughly every couple of hundred years, going back for more than 1,000 years. So California can do bad things with water anyway, but we're supercharging the weather now by putting even more water gas into it. So, I mean, everywhere around the world, you see that when it rains heavier than it used to, including New Zealand, Australia, and everywhere else.
Yeah, as proven by the last couple of weeks.
That's right.
We weren't expecting that. We have usually had that over Christmas, haven't we?
Oh, no, there was forecasting saying this is the sort of thing we'd get in terms of it being a year influenced by what we call the La Nina weather pattern, because that produces a lot more northeasterlies than average over New Zealand, which produces more rain than average in places like Northern Coromandel, Bay of Plenty, round the corner down to Gisborne and Hawke's Bay. So that was the forecast that NIWA put out some months ago. And so that it's interesting that the places in New Zealand that have got rain and the places that don't have rain, like the West Coast, are entirely consistent with what you see in a normal La Nina event, but it's just that the rain has been heavier than it would have been in a La Nina event 50 years ago because of global warming.
How's La Nina affecting Australia?
Oh, that's giving them a lot of rain along the East Coast, many repeated rainfall events there. and some of their flooding has been catastrophic, as we've seen, and been repeat events. So you've had places devastated, dried out, and then a month later they get devastated again, with people saying, this is the worst flood I've ever seen in my life in this town or in this valley. So they'll be looking forward to the end of it, which is La Nina's meant to weaken in 2 or 3 months. And then it's possible we'll go into an El Nino once we get to the latter part of the year. And there's a paradox that although during La Nina in New Zealand, we're warmer than average. In fact, last year was our warmest year on record. La Nina tends to make global temperatures a bit less, even though we have actually had, I think, the sixth warmest year on record globally. But once we go into El Nino, that makes global temperatures go higher because you have a huge part of the Pacific Ocean, which is warmer water than average. So the end result is that the UK Met Service is saying with an El Nino, coming later this year, probably next year, 2024, will break through the 1.5 degrees of global warming that we've been concerned about. So, we're looking at much warmer global conditions coming, even though El Nino tends to make New Zealand a little bit cooler than average.
What part of the year, what time of the year is that likely to appear?
We're usually, if you've got something like a La Nina or an El Nino happening in our summer, it tends to die away in the sort of April-May period. So the La Nina we have now should go away in 2 or 3 months. Then we'll find there'll be a period of a few months that it's what they call neutral. It's neither one or the other. So by the time we get to August, October, it's considered very likely we'll have changed over into an El Nino.
And I see they won't be too happy in Australia with the giant termites.
No, that was an interesting story I came across, that they're meant to be the most primitive termites in the world, the giant northern termites, they call them. And they've been steadily spreading south. And apparently, aside from wood, which they love to eat, they can also eat lead, plastic, ivory and asphalt.
What? Asphalt?
Well, yes. Who knew? And they have this weird behaviour that if for any reason that the queen of the colony dies from an asphalt overdose or something, any one of the termites can then turn itself into another queen. But apparently if they're in a place where the temperature is below 20 degrees centigrade, they go very torpid and slow and can barely move. But with rising temperatures over there, they're heading south and they're heading for Alice Springs. So people are very concerned about what they're going to do about that.
Like a plague of locusts.
Yes. And also the other thing is that, of course, they've been called tiny cows, and that they produce an awful lot of methane. And when you add up all the termites worldwide, that's meant to be about 20 million tonnes of methane a year. Termites are bad news.
Aren't they? Giant, I don't think I've ever seen a termite. How big would a giant termite be?
I'm thinking it could be maybe a couple of centimetres long, but I'm really guessing.
Right. I must have looked at some pictures of it. And on the subject of wildlife, the things are happening, changing rapidly in Alaska.
Well, yes, this was an interesting one because it involved beavers, and everyone likes beavers because they look so staggeringly cute when you see their photos. But as the area up there has been warming and the permafrost has been melting, you've been getting a lot more growth of shrubs and small trees, and that's ideal food for beavers, and that's what they use to make their dams. So the beavers have been spreading north into areas of Alaska where they haven't been for hundreds of thousands of years. And the other thing happens then is that once they put all their dams in position, you get these big ponds behind them, and they absorb sunlight much more than the normal landscape. And the end result is the ponds get a bit warmer, and they start to also melt more permafrost. So it's yet another feedback effect, making climate change worse, because permafrost has got huge amounts of carbon dioxide and methane in it. So as it melts, it releases that into the air. And I saw somewhere a figure that the Arctic's warming faster than the global average, so that the areas of permafrost there have been rising about 3 to 4 degrees centigrade in temperature over the last 30 or 40 years.
So regarding the climate change emergency and the doomsday clock, we see that it's at a record 90 seconds to midnight, although that's been attributed to the Ukraine crisis. But obviously the climate emergency is in there as well. Is there anything positive happening that we can take heart?
I think there is. There's a big increase in renewable electricity, in wind farms and solar panels. I think there are more people getting on bicycles than there used to be. But the crucial thing is that we need people everywhere to be voting in politicians who take this issue seriously. And although it's very easy to describe a sort of doomsday scenario, there's still time if we start to act rapidly to diminish the coal and oil that we're burning, to increase renewable energies, and to do 1,000 little economies of this sort of stuff. So the more consciousness that is spread around to people about the actual dangers we're in and the dangers of sea level rise, I mean, we're already seeing parts of the coast of New Zealand falling into the sea. And I think I read somewhere a year or so ago that the east coast of the United States, with a metre of sea level rise, it takes out something like $400 trillion of real estate. That's from memory. I might have got that figure slightly wrong. But huge value real estate will be disappearing into the sea if we don't put a halt to this.
Well, thank you very much, Eric. You know, there is hope on the horizon. And as you say, we as citizens can only vote for politicians who take it seriously.
Yeah, you can do certain economies in your own private life, but the really big thing is you want the national governments to take it seriously.
Eric, thank you for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
That's the former Met Service severe weather meteorologist Eric Brenstrom, who was in our Wellington studio.